And welcome to Human Rights Radio. We're going to start off with
this song American Indian Movement National Anthem Song. This song was adopted in 1972 in Gordon, Nebraska, when the American Indian Movement went there to protest the judicial handling of an Indian's death. His name was Raymond Yellow Thunder. The song was originally dedicated to the Yellow Thunder family, but because of the story behind it, the Northern Cheyenne people gave this song to the American Indian Movement. And here it is.
Okay, that was the anthem of the American Indian Movement, I believe, right? We're a little, what should I say? We're sort of caught off guard here because our program started before we expected it to. If you were checking your clock when we started up, it was before noon, and so that's a little unusual. Anyway, I'd like to welcome all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio, 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the Internet at cjtr.ca. Whoever, wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Thanks to Canadian band Mr. Something Something from Toronto and the Afrobeat poet Ikwunga for our theme song, You Are Beautiful. My name is Jim Hutchings, and this week again I'm joined by our co-host Mona Hill, and our guest today is Sue Durage from the Peruvians Before Profit, among many other interests that she has. And she's going to update us on the situation we discussed some weeks ago about the Bagua massacre and the fundraising event held in Regina to assist the victims and their families. Welcome, Sue.
Thank you.
Anyway, take it away, Mona.
Hi, everybody. We're here. It's nice to have you back. And the other thing we're going to talk about today with Sue is the fact that the week of May 30th, 2010, is officially Saskatchewan Mining Week. And it might seem a little odd for Human Rights Radio to be talking about mining, but once we get into it, you'll see that it really isn't, and it fits in to Indigenous rights issues locally and basically internationally. So I think the first thing we wanted to do was get an update from Sue on the Peruvians Before Profit group and the fundraising and what you were able to accomplish with that, Sue.
Okay, it is called the Solidarity Committee for the Peruvian Amazon, but it was, you know, the advertisements were Peruvians Before Profit, which is okay.
Yeah.
We managed to raise $3,000, which was phenomenal. And I went back to Peru and went to a few communities and gave the money to widows, mothers, fathers, brothers, wounded people, and it was quite emotional. The widows have received money from time to time, sporadically from different groups, even from Germany, whatever, but the wounded had never been given a penny prior to this, so it was very emotional. It was very worthwhile. When I was coming back, when I was driving back, there's different security checks, and one of them is an Indigenous security check, and they said, wait, and they ran in, and they got this envelope for me, and it was this big thank you letter to the committee, and it actually had pictures of, like, they have national identity cards, and they had the wounded's identity cards on there, and they said that anybody that had contributed to this money would be welcomed with open arms into their community, and they were eternally grateful. It was one of the first times there was no intermediaries. I came directly there and handed it right to the widows and the wounded, etc. Usually an organization gets it, and then somebody delivers it, and then it goes to the community, and then it has to be distributed, and then it gets less and less and less. And they said this was the first that somebody directly came in and said, here.
Wow.
And met with the people. And I did fine until I went to meet with the father of a young 18-year-old that was killed in the Bagua massacre, which it's Saturday is the one-year anniversary. And he was just, he lost it, and I did fine in front of him, but when I left, I broke down. I had had it. I had had a whole morning that started at 4 o'clock in the morning, meeting with families, and seeing him, and we were alone, and him just so decimated by an 18-year-old son, I mean, who had a whole life in front of him, murdered. I couldn't handle it. I finally fell apart. But luckily, I didn't do it in front of him. I hugged him and held him up. But later, I went and fell apart all alone.
That takes a lot of strength. I don't know if I could have done that.
Well, you probably would have. You do what you got to do.
I tend to break down with the people.
Well, I knew that wouldn't be too good for him. And one of the wounded men had never received a penny. And that was in a different community later on. And he started crying. And it was very, very emotional to have this kind of reception. And people were so, so very grateful to what we had done in Regina and said, we hope it's not the last time. We're going to need ongoing support, which is true, because they're in a survival community. And the wounded can't work anymore. And if they can't work, how do they feed their families? And because the women tend to the plantations and the men do the hunting, that affects the women too, and that's why we gave also to mothers and fathers, because over there the people that were murdered also contributed to their whole family.
Sue, for those listeners who weren't able to hear the previous show that you were on, and who were not aware of the massacre, could you just sort of briefly outline what precipitated,
okay,
pardon me, this fundraiser and your need to do this?
Okay, well, I've been working with those communities for a number of years, long before there was problems or anything. I was doing community development, and we created an ancestral school. But what had happened is that mining companies are moving in to Peru in general, and 40% of mining in Peru is done by Canadian companies. And where I work, it's Dorado Mines, which is in Vancouver, and I just found on the internet that there's a new company called New Dimensions that's just going to go in there from Vancouver as well. And under Peruvian law, there were decrees that allowed these companies to come into their territory without prior and informed consent, without anything, and mine and do what they pleased. And the people said, no, this can't happen. Especially if you think about the ILO 169 and the Declaration of Indigenous Rights, which Canada has not adhered to either. But anyways, had to get that dig in.
Oh, it's important. Very important.
But they're saying now you're breaking that. And they were also breaking the Peruvian Constitution, which says foreigners can't come in. However, what these companies have been doing, Dorado Mines bought Afrodita, which was a Peruvian company. They bought it out 100%. And when they bought it out, of course, they got all their permits and everything else.
Because they became a Peruvian mining company.
Yeah. So that's how they circumvented that. And the people said, that's enough. We can't have this. We will die if mining comes in here. We will die.
Why would they die if mining show up?
Okay, they live on the river. The river is everything. I mean, that's your water supply. That's how you get from one community to another. That's where the fish are. So mining, we know what it does to water. If that water is gone, they're dead. Mm-hmm. If the forests are cut down, they live from hunting, then there's no more animals. They're dead. Like somebody said in a meeting there at one point, we're millionaires. We are millionaires. And what he meant was because everybody there has a home because they build it out of natural resources. Everybody eats because there's the animals and the fish and everything. If that mining comes in, we will only have contamination, sickness, and we will cease to exist.
Right. So they decided to protest.
Yes, and so 2008, they went and blocked the road. And the Peruvian government met and met and met and said, okay, fine, we will get rid of some of the decrees. So they went home. But the president, Alan Garcia, would not sign off on it. And so even though they went home, nothing changed. So in April of 2009, they went back to block the roads and said, we will not leave until the decrees are gone. We're not leaving because we trusted you. Last time we went back and nothing changed. On June 5th, interestingly enough, several things happened. They did get tired. They did get hungry. They wanted to go home and regroup. There was still talk about looking at the decrees. And they negotiated with the police and said, we will leave at 10 o'clock in the morning on June 5th. We're out of here.
That was this year.
This year. No, last year. Last year.
Yeah.
And they said, that's it. We're gone. So, fine. But interestingly enough, that was exactly the time that the free trade agreement was signed with Canada and the U.S. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, for people that were preparing to go home, who were unarmed in the first place, had wooden lances, which are cultural. Those wooden lances come to meetings. I've been at meetings. Yeah, they're symbols.
Yeah.
And they're protection. They mean a lot. They mean strength. They mean protection. They mean everything. And that's all they had this whole time was wooden lances. So 5 o'clock in the morning, helicopters came above them, tear gas was dropped, and fire was opened on them. And nobody really knows how many people died. They are saying that there was 10 Awahoon and Wampis dead and 24 police. We're not sure. A big emphasis was put on the police that died,
yes,
but not on the Awahoon. And
right.
The Awahoon even apologized for the police. Nobody apologized for the death of the Awahoon. And it's unfortunate. We mourn everybody's death. Mm-hmm. Even the commander who was killed there, his wife joined a class action suit with the indigenous people saying, my husband would not have been dead if you had not ordered open fire on these people, and I stand with them.
Wow.
So that's pretty phenomenal.
That's very powerful for her to do that.
And Saturday is going to be 1 year since the massacre, so we're going to do something about that in Regina.
Yes.
We are going to be meeting at City Hall because that's near Farmers Market. And we're going to distribute a handout on Dorado Mines that happens to be in Awahoon territory. And we're going to have a memorial for the people that lost their lives there. And it wasn't just Awahoon and Wampis. It was Métis supporters. It was police. And we have to remember, these police also were just working class people. Many people were sacrificed that day.
By the government.
By the government. And we want to do a memorial for the people that we want to mention, the people who are gone. We want to raise awareness about Canadian mining overseas. We want to advocate for Bill C-300, which is a new bill, a private bill that's up in front of the Canadian government to regulate Canadian mining companies operating overseas. Hopefully it will pass, and then hopefully we can pass something for us nationally, because as First Nations, we need protection like that as well. And we also want to support a free and just trial of Alberto Pisango. He was the leader of ADECEP when the blockade happened, and he had to get asylum in Nicaragua because they charged him with treason and sedition and a whole bunch of other causes, and they're blaming him for the massacre.
It sounds like they're basically blaming him for the whole thing.
They're blaming him for the whole thing. He wasn't even at the front lines when it happened. He was in Lima, but they're blaming him, and he was in exile and decided to come home. Was it yesterday or the day before? I think it was the day before. He
was
released.
The day before.
And he came, and he was accompanied by Gregor McLean, I think, from Amazon Watch, and Karyanka Kilcher, who's an actress, and she's part Quechua from Peru. And they came in, and before he could even get into immigration, they arrested him. Right. And there was enough pressure that he's out on what we would call bail here. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of different conditions on his release, and he's out. And now we just want to make sure that there's going to be a fair and just trial, because who knows how it could go.
Right. There were a number of human rights organizations involved in protesting that arrest, and Amnesty was involved.
Oh, yes. In fact, at the rally, we're going to have Amnesty's petition there for people to sign for Alberto Pisango.
Excellent.
So, I mean, this is a kind of, and it's quite interesting that we didn't plan it this way. We planned to have this activity because it was June 5th. It's a year after the massacre. And then all of a sudden we saw these big banners that's the last day of Saskatchewan Mining Week.
Right. So we thought this would be very apropos to discuss Saskatchewan Mining Week, because it's all related. It's an interconnected web that we're looking at here.
It's very interconnected, and Saskatchewan mining affects me personally.
Yes, it does.
And I just went back home to have a reunion with family.
Where was home?
In Fort McMurray. Well, home is further north, but that's where a lot of the family lives. Mm-hmm. And found out that, yes, indeed, they closed Amok Mine, which forced us out of our community up in northern Saskatchewan. But now they are looking, they just said they wanted, they didn't explain why they want to bulldoze our traditional trap line, where there are grave sites and the last remnants of our cabins, which they had said we could go back to. Now they want to bulldoze the area, so I did some investigation on the internet and found out that since for about the last 2 years, they've been looking at leases and doing more uranium mining for high-grade uranium. There are three different blocks, and I guess our trap line falls on that, so now...
Well, that's really interesting that you should bring that up, because, I mean, really, this is the perfect segue into the manual that's online on the Saskatchewan Mining Organization or Association's website.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was going through it, and I found a section that talks about community engagement and best practices in mining in Saskatchewan. And there's far too much for me to read. It was a 79-page document. But I went and I picked out some highlights. The highlights cover, first of all, they mentioned that from the end of the best practices management, this is from the end of the best practices management manual. It says, First Nations and Métis community engagement is intended to, the guide is intended as a practical guide for companies undertaking mineral exploration in communities. And it also covers forestry. This document also outlines surface permitting requirements in relation to First Nations and Métis consultation, the community engagement process described in this best management practice should be applied well in advance of an exploration company's request for a permit to conduct work on Crown lands. Effective community engagement is essential to the development of positive and long-term relationships and has the potential to expedite the project development process and enhance benefits for both local communities and industry. The guidance provided in this document is not meant to be all-encompassing or prescriptive. The nature and extent of community engagement activities are shaped by many factors, including the type, scope, and location of an exploration program and the magnitude of impact it generates. And it goes on to state the principles provided herein can also apply in northern Saskatchewan, where an exploration or development program may impact a First Nations or Métis community.
Well, they are bringing in people to talk about this and our family to talk about this. That's how we stumbled on them wanting to bulldoze this area. And they're not really listening to what's being said.
Oh, it's interesting here because it says that what community engagement is intended to provide opportunity for listening and responding to community concerns.
Well, they are. I don't know whether they're listening, but there's been several trips of bringing people in. And I guess when you come to our land, I don't even know if they think it's ours, because way back in the 70s when we got forced out of there,
right?
Long before we were forced out, we went and said we wanted to make a land claims, and they said, no, it's unoccupied Crown land, you're fine. And then when we went back, they said, sorry, it's occupied Crown land, you can't do anything. And we were told in the beta inquiries, and we had international support, and we did a lot of things. And Lloyd Barber, who was the minister of, I don't know if it was energy or whatever it was at that time, I can't remember, said that legally we were trespassing and morally we weren't.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, because we have grave sites there, and that's, you know,
yes,
been the traditional territory of my ex-father-in-law for a long, long time.
Right.
But so morally we weren't trespassing, and then somebody bought that land, and we went to him and said, can we go back? And he said, sure, go live on it, because he bought a big piece of it. But we tested the water, and the water is all contaminated, so it's really hard to live there. And now to hear that they want to bulldoze everything, which includes grave sites, that's very upsetting. And we're going to have to find ways and means to be part of this negotiation and probably to stop that.
It fits perfectly with what's going on here. And, I mean, you know, one might think that this sounds very good. This sounds, in theory, very good, that the mining companies and the forestry companies must consider the advice of communities and relevant exploration permitting processes, develop goodwill and a better understanding of community objectives and priorities leading to confidence in decisions, and jointly establish a realistic understanding of potential outcomes.
Well, maybe that's why they're not there yet, and maybe that's why they're talking to us, but I mean,
This historically hasn't been like that, has it?
No, I mean,
no.
We were forced out of there.
Right.
And that's what we're saying. Funny, they forced us out of there. They didn't care about us. And now all of a sudden when they want to do something, they're bringing us in to talk to us. Like,
well, and it's interesting, too, because I'm looking at some requirements of the Forest Resources Management Act and regulations. And it says, the applicant, which is the forest company, must determine the volume of timber harvested during clearing operations. And it talks about how to do it, how to carry out an assessment. Clearing of vegetation must be kept to a minimum, it says. But it doesn't say in here, there doesn't seem to be anything in here about communication with the indigenous people that are living there about how much timber should be harvested or cleared. I'm not sure. It's not clear in this. It also explains that to minimize soil disturbance, clearing with heavy machinery should be limited to frozen or dry and stable ground conditions unless low-impact equipment is utilized as authorized by SE, whatever that is. To limit the number of trees cut, utilize existing roads, trails, and cut lines. what kind of impact does that have using existing trails and cut lines? Where possible, avoid areas covered by standing timber and regenerate.
And how are they going to do that in northern Saskatchewan?
I'm not sure.
And they're bringing the tar sands to La Loche now, by the way.
And existing trails and trap lines are not to be blocked.
Well, there
how
you go.
How do you feel about that, Suzanne? We have 1 minute.
Okay. How do I feel? They shouldn't be blocked. And then what are they doing there?
Yeah.
Well, they're trying to get trees, I guess. Let's take a break.
All right.
We'll come back and continue this conversation.
Okay, I'm just going to mention the CJTR Music Garage Sale that's going to be held Saturday, June 12th. We don't know, we don't know for a while whether the space from our office is available. Hold it just a second here. I'm reading something that really didn't make any difference, but I'm going to tell you here now that this year's Music Garage Sale is Saturday, June 12th. It's an important fundraiser for community radio, and you can help by donating merchandise for the event. We're accepting CDs, DVDs, vinyl records, and you can drop off your donations during regular business hours between Monday and Friday. And if a drop-off is not possible, call us at 525-7274 to arrange for pickup. Make your donation now, and thanks for supporting Community Radio, CJTR.
Oh, yeah.
That was Madrigaya from Winnipeg and their song, The Heart Song, and apparently is based on an Aboriginal tune or Aboriginal music. I'd just like to mention before we get going here that 91.3 FM CJTR is a proud sponsor of the 2010 Cathedral Village Arts Festival, and you're invited to stop by the CJTR Athol Street stage during the street fair May 29th. I haven't been down there. Has anyone been down there? No?
This weather, probably not.
Well, hopefully the...
I know there was an outside concert last night that was moved into Westminster Church.
Okay.
Yeah. Drumming concert and fire night or something. That we had missed, unfortunately.
Yeah, the weather hasn't been kind. And another thing I'd just like to mention before we get going here that is that May is membership month at CJTR, and as a volunteer programmer, I'm a member and Mona's a member of Regina Community Radio. Membership gave us the opportunity to apply to do this show, and now here we are every week having a great time and gaining valuable experience. Most of CJTR's programs are hosted by people just like us. So if you have an idea for a show, why not get involved? Membership is only $25 a year. Join up online at www.cjtr.ca, drop by our studios at 1102 8th Avenue during office hours, or visit the CJTR booth at the Cathedral Village Arts Festival. So, that's the housework out of the way there.
Okay.
Housekeeping.
So we're back now.
Yes.
And we're back with Sue Durange. We're talking about mining. Saskatchewan Mining Week is the week of May 30th. And we're making a connection here between mining in Canada, Canadian mining companies who go into Indigenous lands in other parts of the world and in developing nations, and basically the havoc that's being raised. We've been discussing this during the first half hour of the show. And the second half now, what I want to do is I want to talk about the Saskatchewan Mining Association Mineral Exploration and Community Engagement Best Practices. There's a number of best practices. It's all in a manual, and I found it online on the Saskatchewan Mining Association website. And I wanted to highlight some of the things here. And Sue's going to respond to them from her perspective. And she has a long history from many years back with the mining industry, the forestry industry in northern Saskatchewan. And she also is, I would call her an expert on these issues because she's been doing plenty of work. What organization had you done work with? CETA, was it?
Well, CETA is just the ancestral school. It's not mining
okay.
work. But, I mean, what that ancestral school was is to keep people solidified in their culture and their teachings, to have proper stewardship of the land so that they could survive with this encroachment of mining. So it indirectly has to do with mining. But
right.
while I was doing this project, I happened to work with people that faced these horrible things because of mining. And mm-hmm. so I don't know if I'm an expert. I don't like that term, but
okay.
I've certainly been thrown...
Nobody ever does when I call them an expert.
but I've certainly been thrown in the fray of mining, both by mm-hmm. when it came and attacked me personally, and now with these people that I love. And sometimes they say, I don't know why this has to keep following me around, but I guess there's a reason.
It's meant to be.
Yeah.
So I just want to quickly repeat what I said before. From this manual, it says... this best management practice is intended as a practical guide for companies undertaking mineral exploration in Saskatchewan on how to foster and sustain effective working relationships with First Nations and Métis communities. And they outline surface permitting requirements in relation to First Nation Métis consultation. So the whole thing seems to be focused on the interconnection between mining companies and First Nation communities. And there's a number of topics that they discuss in here. There's the requirements of the Forest Resource Management Act and regulations, and we were talking earlier about some of it, a few of them, the general clearing requirements, for instance. Oh, here's one. Unless other methods are otherwise approved, hand clearing must be done within 100 meters of water, through steep or unstable terrain, or areas as directed by the contact, for example, through protected areas, especially designated areas. So I'm not sure 100 meters of water. Well, I guess they wouldn't want to bring machinery in there, maybe, to destroy anything.
And then it says unless otherwise approved. So who does the approval?
Well, that's a good question. Then there's general clearing requirements, measuring the length and width of total clearing, excluding lake or stream crossings, and applying the average. And there's a formula. Carrying out timber assessments. Any clearing of vegetation should be kept to a minimum to minimize soil disturbance. Clearing with heavy machinery should, I read this before the break, be limited to frozen or dry and stable ground conditions unless low-impact equipment is utilized. To limit the number of trees cut, utilize existing roads, trails, and cut lines. And how do you respond to that?
I just feel like, well, what do they mean by existing?
Lines that they haven't, roads that they haven't cleared themselves, I would suspect.
I guess so.
I suspect.
And when you consider northern Saskatchewan, a lot of it's not inhabited, so that gives them a lot of free rein.
I'm wondering if they're also considering trails to be like trapping trails.
I don't know.
Where possible, avoid areas covered by standing timber and regeneration areas. It talks about existing trails and trap lines are not to be blocked. What's your experience with that?
Well,
tell us.
I guess if you shove people out of an area, then you're not blocking a trap line, are you?
Okay.
And I don't know. There's all kinds of loopholes with that. I'm sure there's loopholes with that. And maybe there's some trap lines they're not blocking. Maybe there's some they are blocking. I mean, and how do you define blocking?
Okay.
How do you define blocking? If I work 50 feet away and you can still get to your trail, then am I blocking you? Mm-hmm. I mean, all of this is really ambiguous.
Okay.
It sounds good, but in theory, but in practice, what's your definition? It would be, how do you define each of these things?
Right.
The other question that I would have is, who is enforcing the rules?
Exactly.
Who is going to monitor what's going on? And I don't know. I have no experience or knowledge, but I suspect that you don't see very many people there who are inspecting to make sure these rules are carried out. Now, whose rules are these? Are these rules that have been laid down by the Mining Association?
This comes from the Saskatchewan Mining Association.
They're best practices.
Best practices.
Yes.
So
I don't know about the monitoring.
I would suspect then that they don't have the force of law. It's just saying, oh, this is what we try to do.
And if you're thinking of the remoteness of northern Saskatchewan, and they might not even know where there's trap lines.
Right.
These companies, and who would keep going to all the trap lines?
To check and see if they're blocked. Right.
Or to even know where each and every one is. Because different families have different trap lines. It's not like, oh, this is a designated trap line area.
Yeah.
Different families have different trap lines that have been passed on from generation to generation, and even new places that they've gone because mining has also affected migration of animals. I know right before we left, we were starving because they built a camp down the river, and because of the noise and the people, all the animals were migrating different, even the fish. We used to have full fish nets, and one day we went down there and had one fish in there. So, I mean...
Yeah.
Right. Oh, to answer your question, Jim, it says this document is not intended to have any legal effect.
Nor should
it be viewed as fully reflecting the legal obligations of government or government's expectations of industry with respect to First Nation and Métis consultation.
So let's
go back to the camps. Camps, they suggest they need to provide additional approval for camp located within the following areas. 1.6 kilometers from the center line of designated canoe routes.
Designated by whom?
Who knows? 1.6 kilometers from any settlement, surface dispositions, or titled property.
And if you think about, since time immemorial, those were all canoe routes. Everything was a canoe route. So then I guess that says the whole land. I know they don't see it that way, but to me, that's all designated canoe routes because that's how everybody went from point A to point B since time immemorial.
And this is a First Nation perspective that you're giving us.
Yes.
Yes.
So,
and so there is the consultation,
So I'm just back to these. I'm just curious. The people that wrote this, supposedly this was, these things were written, these guidelines were written in consultation with...
Well, this is what it looks like. It looks like they're suggesting that it was.
It probably was. I mean, you can consult with all kinds of people. Plus, like I'm saying, in theory, all of this is good.
Yeah.
But what is the practice?
Yeah.
Right.
So whoever they consulted with, in theory, gave them some good guidelines.
Yeah. Yeah. We've got no teeth.
Yeah.
Basically.
Like it said, this is not legally binding.
Yeah.
So it's great that it's there, but they don't have to do anything.
Right.
This kind of speaks, to, as far as I'm concerned, it speaks to a trend that's been going on in government for a very long time, where the government wants to get out of the business of enforcing anything, inspecting anything, or regulating anything. They want business, they want companies to regulate themselves. And I think that it causes problems because it's the fox in charge of the hen house kind of thing, you know?
And that's why I go back to, I'm an advocate of Bill C-300,
yes.
And I want it to pass, but we also need a Bill C-301 or something that will protect us in Canada, and especially First Nations and Métis communities, because what we're experiencing, as I had mentioned to Mona earlier, is environmental racism. If you look at where all the mining and the minings are going on, it's usually on Indigenous land. And that's internationally, locally, nationally, whatever.
Sure.
It's on Indigenous territory. Why? Because it's so remote. Two, because of racism in the first place. And if you look at all the gains and wins, it's usually because there's a non-Aboriginal community that's affected. And all of a sudden, you can block it and you can win. When you get into these remote Aboriginal communities, Indigenous communities, then it's so far away, people aren't really kicking and screaming, and there's not enough political clout or power, and it gets done, and it's a form of genocide, and it's environmental racism.
And
on that note, we can talk about dealing with wildlife on site. You have mentioned numerous times that your people, the people in other on other territories all over the Americas, end up losing the wildlife and losing their food source. And there's a section in here on wildlife, and it says wildlife become habituated to humans occupying their territories. Conflict between humans and habituated wildlife may arise where sensitive habitat, food sources, or when humans or wildlife are threatened, injured, or destroyed. That, throughout the whole thing, that seems to be the only spot where I've noted anything about in reference to wildlife being threatened, injured, or destroyed, that one sentence. Every attempt should be made to prevent wildlife from becoming habituated to human sites. And then it goes on, and it gives a number of guidelines, such as food storage, interacting with wildlife, no animals should be fed, no wildlife should be allowed to interfere with routine human activity.
Do not feed the bears.
Routine human activity. So what happens if they do interfere with it?
Well, they wildlife that disrupt traffic flow, approach or chase people at any time, and approach or enter vehicles and buildings on a regular basis. Once a week or more is a regular basis. Should be subject to controlled harassment by designated staff.
How do you control harassment?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Part of conditioning wildlife to avoid sites is to make them feel uncomfortable around people, no matter what the activity. No wild animals should be allowed to threaten people on and adjacent to camp. I don't see anything in here about the other way around, about anyone threatening wildlife. Anyway, we could get into that after. Not allowing them to feed peacefully on site or at garbage dumps. There is this controlled harassment by approved means, and apparently there are scare permits issued by Saskatchewan Environment, and that will help to prevent wildlife from becoming habituated. Designated staff at camp should be the only people carrying out controlled harassment under a scare permit issued by Saskatchewan Environment. This picture that it's being painted to me is not looking good.
So I wonder if they're going to start doing that in workplaces where we have lateral violence and everything else. Will certain administrators be able to have a scare permit to staff? I mean, animals are living beings, and now they have permits to harass them.
They absolutely do. I don't see anything in here about protecting the animals, quite frankly, except in that one sentence.
Where's PETA?
yeah. people visiting or working or residing at the camp should be given training and education about local wildlife. It is important to become aware of what wildlife species might be encountered, what kind of behavior to expect from each, and the level of risk to people. Once again, they're concerned about the level of risk, which, I mean, okay, that's understandable. It's important to understand the kinds of human actions and activities. There we go. There's one more that can place wildlife at risk on and adjacent to this site. Finally, it is important for people to be aware that what is being done to reduce or eliminate conflict between people and wildlife. So there is a best practices management program for wildlife. And once again, as we said earlier, this is sounds very subjective, extremely subjective. It's kind of ethereal out there, you know. I don't know. Maybe there's more. Maybe there's another manual to do this or something. Then there's best practices about hazardous waste. You were telling me during the break about something pictures of.
Yeah, I have some pictures of what they've done in the Clough Lake mining site, and there's pictures of, I don't know what, it looks like metals or whatever it is, and they're just burying it there. And they're
trying. It's not in a container?
It didn't look like it. I'd have to relook at the pictures, because I just kind of saw them fleetingly. I have to study them. My niece gave them to me. And they're trying to reforest, and they've had these shrubs for years that they're trying to grow, and they're not doing anything, but I guess
they're not growing.
And what concerns me, though, is what I know about uranium is that some of the toxins and the tailings have a 200,000 year lifespan. So how many generations is that? And if you bury it, what good's that going to do? I mean, once it's released, what good is it going to do anyways? It's there, and it's there for many, many, many generations of people.
It says the best management practice of drilling on land. Where possible, all efforts shall be used to prevent drill mud, return water, and cuttings or sludge from running uncontrolled from the site or to within 100 meters of water body. Where possible.
And when
all
it's not
efforts
possible,
shall be used.
And when it's not possible, it doesn't matter, right?
Right. It doesn't go on
well, look
say
at
anymore.
Look at the tailings at the tar sand where 1,600 ducks died. Mm-hmm. And when they went to apologize to the community of Fort Chipewyan, then it came out that, well, it wasn't just ducks, that bear and moose and all kinds of other animals had died there. So if wherever possible, I guess it wasn't quote-unquote possible.
It must not have been possible, I guess. Appropriate sediment and erosion control measures may need to be implemented to prevent deleterious substances from entering fish habitat. Once again, may be needed. The applicant must identify in the application any drilling additives that will be used in the program. Wherever possible, biodegradable mud and non-toxic additives should be used.
Okay, when they identify it, what does it matter?
There's
always this clause, wherever possible. So that leaves this big wide space that they can just say, well, it wasn't possible, and it's over.
I really think that what has to happen is that government has to step up and monitor the situation and not be more concerned with the profitability of the company and more concerned with the health of the land and the people.
That's true. And beyond that is, in the end, if they poison us all, then who can they drink their money, eat their money, or breathe their money?
When you're sitting in Toronto, it doesn't seem to matter that much, you know, or Calgary or
but
Vancouver.
But it will go there. The animals that are up north come down south. The waters that flow all eventually come together.
Yeah.
The air will come here, and it will poison us all. All of us. This is an issue for everyone. Although it's happening a lot on Indigenous territory, this is an issue for everybody.
It is. I'll continue with these best management practices for drilling on land. You continue to just give us your opinion on this, Sue. Drill mud solids or cuttings with a uranium concentration greater than 0.05% are to be collected and then disposed of down the drill hole and sealed.
Well, that's nice.
Okay. It doesn't say how to seal it. I'm sure they must have some idea.
Cement.
Okay. Doesn't work underwater, apparently. Noise abatement devices. And here we go back to what you talked about companies coming in and making all that noise. And it's not just your experience. We have experience from the Lupercon Cree, the Fort Chipewyan, so many indigenous populations up north, and their land noise has driven off the animals, right? Driven off their food supply.
Any noise.
Number 17 says, noise abatement devices, including mufflers and shrouding, are to be used near populated areas.
Define populated.
Yeah.
Populated by whom?
One or two?
I don't know.
Or what?
What's populated? Considering the remoteness once more of the north and the trap lines and everything, populated by whom and how many, and what's the definition of populated?
So if you're 5 miles away from a population and you don't use noise abatement devices, but the animals use a trail that goes through your land where you trap them or you hunt them, and the animals are scared off and find another way to go, what happens?
You don't have... I know firsthand what happens.
Tell us, yeah.
Because when Clough Lake came up there, Amok Mining, they had a camp on Carswell Lake where I lived, and it was about a two-hour walk to that camp. But as soon as there was any noise, and the animals aren't going to stay around. Look, the animals are more afraid of us than we are of them. They want to be safe from humans. They're not going to stick around. Any noise will affect them. Even smelling the humans there will affect them. So where we had an abundance of moose and rabbits and fish, it was gone. Even the fish migrated differently. We would pull up our fish net, and it used to be full. And when the mining company was there, one day we went there, and there was one fish in there, one. We were going hungry. The animals are smart. They're not going to stick around. They might say that it's loud noises that scare them. It's any noise that scares them. When you think, when we live quietly in our trap lines, of course they weren't affected. The mine came to us and said, help us get rid of the bears. What do you do to keep the bears around? We said, the bears don't even come to us. They're coming to you because of garbage and noise.
Right, right. And I'm assuming the same thing is happening in Peru, in El Salvador.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. In African countries.
Of course.
Where they're mining. Everywhere.
Of course.
Right.
Animals are smart. They're not going to stick around.
Right. All of this is happening.
This is universal. What's happening here, what's happening everywhere else, it's universal. The only thing that's a little bit different is they can't outright come and shoot us here like they're doing in South America and elsewhere.
And as we celebrate Saskatchewan Mining Week, we'd like to keep this in mind, this conversation in mind that we've had with Sue Duranger. We'd like to keep in mind Bill C-300. If you're uncertain about what it's about, go and find it online. If you want to give us a real quick rundown, we got about 30 seconds left.
Well, Bill C-300 is going to monitor what's happening overseas, and anybody can call in, a Canadian citizen, a citizen from there. And don't forget to come on Saturday at 11 o'clock to City Hall to support Bill C-300, to remember the fallen Awahoon, to protect Alberto Pisango, and to protect all citizens here and abroad from the bad practices of mining.
Thank you, Sue.
Okay. Alrighty, that just wraps it up, and we hope you've enjoyed listening to and have learned something new about human rights for all people. Myself, Jim Hutchings, and Mona Hill are volunteers with Amnesty International, and our goal is to increase the awareness of and contribute to a discussion of human rights issues at home and around the world. Every day and every moment in every corner of the world, injustice cries out for your intervention. No one individual can respond to all the problems of the world, of course. To paraphrase a great humanitarian, if you can't help everybody, just help one. And whether the abuses stop immediately or take a long time to end, the gift of your attention and intervention can make a profound and positive impact on the ability of individuals and communities to endure and prevail. Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."